To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious, and hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, and I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have C.L. Polk, author of Witchworld, her debut novel from Tor.com Publishing. Welcome to the show, C.L.
Hi.
So, first things first, tell me about yourself and your work.
Okay, well, I am a novelist. I live in Calgary, Alberta, and Witchmark is my first novel.
Witchmark is set in a world resembling post-World War I England, with all the problems that that era came with, like the return of soldiers with PTSD, massive class issues, etc. What made this era so intriguing to you and the best place to set this story?
It was the technology level. I was looking for something that was post-industrial, but not quite at the computer age or the age of aviation, and that pretty much put me squarely in the technology level of the early 20th century. I wanted a world that was past the Industrial Revolution and also edging away from like the steampunk genre or aesthetic or whatever you want to call it. I was actually very interested in the period following World War I. I know a lot of people, they think it was World War I and then it was the Roaring Twenties and everything was wonderful. And that's not exactly true. And I wanted to explore kind of the aftermath of the first terrible worldwide war. I didn't have a world war in my book, but I did have a lot of the earmarks of World War I technology and also the way that they fought happening in the background. What I really wanted to touch on was basically the first time anybody were aware of the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. In World War I, after that period, they called it shell shock, and they, unlike in my book, put it down to a character weakness, a morality defect, and that this actually kind of damaged the perception of soldiers and soldiering, because the idea was is that you sent your best, your strongest and your most brilliant to fight for you, and then coming back traumatized, it really affected the way that a country kind of perceived itself. And I didn't really want to do that. I wanted to have kind of a perspective of someone recognizing that what these soldiers went through was a horrible thing, and I wanted to kind of touch on the feeling of disconnection and of deep-seated guilt that comes from surviving a traumatic experience. And World War I was kind of the first period where there was serious thought expended on post-traumatic stress disorder. And I basically went with the period because I wanted the technology level and I wanted to speculate on what it would be like if medicine was a slightly more prepared to accept post-traumatic stress disorder as a real thing that happens. And I also had this vision in my mind of this city that was kind of like a early 20th century city, just when, you know, the skyscraper was coming about. So I have tall buildings, but I also kind of wanted to explore the idea of speculating on what would have happened if the bicycle craze of the Victorian age hadn't died and automobiles had taken the bicycle's place. So that was an important part of my world building. It was more of a vision, and then I looked around at history to find what fit my vision, than me saying, oh, gee, I want to write a book that's set in approximately 1918 with bicycles.
I love that. So was it really just because you love bicycles?
My reasoning for using bicycles was that one of the things that I don't really go into with Witchmark is that when they were using coal and oil and gas in what would have been their equivalent of the Victorian age, because weather mages control the country, they recognize the environmental impact of using those fuels early. And I have in my research a newspaper clipping from, I believe it's about 1908, basically saying that scientists have already detected differences in the atmosphere and weather conditions as a result of 100 years of coal and oil and gas in England. And so aether was kind of the substitute power that they wanted to use in order to replace fossil fuels.
Right, right, right. That's fascinating. That makes perfect sense now. So in the book, you have the Storm Singers, which you just mentioned, and clearly they, just based on that brief synopsis, quite a bit of power. Can you tell us how the magic system works and also a little bit more about the world that the Storm Singers and your main character, Miles, exist in?
Let's see. The magic system is really simple. Magic is the exertion of your will upon reality. That's it. And the source of magic is your own personal life energy or your soul energy. And that's all there is to it. There's nothing else. That's it. Souls power magic. You have a soul. If you have a soul of sufficient power, you are a magician. And politically is where the system gets interesting, because Aelin was founded by a provincial leader who wanted to pull the ancestral Aelish lands away from an empire. And in order to revolt, she basically set up her territory, said, "This is ours. We claim it. We're going to be independent from you." And they fought a war. And in the middle of this war, 100 magicians show up. Like, no explanation. Just all of a sudden, bam, there they are, 100 magicians. And they basically tell Agnes that they will help her win this war as long as, you know, they have a place to live and safety, and that they continue to serve their country and all this other stuff. Those 100 mages are the direct ancestors of the Royal Knights of Aelin, who are like the highest aristocratic class in Aelin. They are all magicians, and they essentially run the government. The government has two separate branches of control, the lower elected house, which is partial democracy, and the cabinet, which is a bunch of magicians, although nobody actually knows this. They keep their magic a secret. And in order to control the country and keep their magic a secret, they have introduced a law that protects Aelin from the dangers of witches. The idea is that magic is real, witches are real, but witches are dangerous because using magic causes them to lose their reason. And once they've lost their reason completely, they invariably become violent and wind up hurting people. So what they do is, if you're found out to be a witch, you are considered to be a danger to society and you're shunted away into an asylum hospital that is supposed to keep you safe.
Gotcha. So what's the difference then between magicians and witches?
Who were they born to? That's it.
Ah, of course.
Magicians and witches are exactly the same. Their power comes from the same source. It's just a matter of class. That's the only thing that divides them.
Very, very interesting. So one of the things that I was super excited about in terms of your story is that this is also a male-male romance.
Yes.
Which is awesome. And I hate that this is something notable, because it shouldn't be. Should be kind of a natural course of things. Yes, we have queer characters. Yes, that's totally normal. But right now it still is notable. So why did you want to explore a queer relationship within the context of this world that you've built?
I didn't really have a big reason. Part of it was before I got my start writing original stories, I was writing fanfic. And as you know, fanfics are really heavy on the male-male relationships. And when I originally came up with the idea and the character, I was looking around for the links and connections to that character. And one is Miles' sister and the whole situation that he has going on with his family background and why he wanted to escape it. The other was that I needed the character to push him into having the adventure I wanted him to have. Because if I'd left Miles on his lonesome, he would be wandering around an underfunded hospital trying to figure out a way to keep all of his patients, even though even more soldiers are coming home from the war, and they all desperately need his help, stretching himself thin and trying to figure out how to solve the problem and the medical mystery that he has, where some of his patients all seem to share the same conviction that there's something inside of them that is not of them that is trying to take control. And that's what Miles would have done. But I needed him to go on a different adventure. And so I thought up a character and realized that this was also my romantic relationship, that they were going to fall in love in the course of solving this mystery.
I hear it's quite the adorable relationship.
They're pretty cute. I have them cooperate and get along a lot. There's not really like an enemies to lovers kind of a trope. They just click when they meet each other. And so their relationship is very light and soft and doesn't really have a lot of trouble attached to it.
Aww, that's so wonderful sounding. Given that this is a romance, but also a fantasy, but also, as you mentioned, a mystery, which, frankly, genre mashup is my favorite genre. How do you balance sort of the touch points of each of the genres while also building an entire world for them to inhabit?
By accident.
Excellent answer.
I did not sit down in front of my computer and say, I'm going to write a fantasy novel with a romance and a mystery mashed in there. I had some ideas that were floating around in my mind. I had this character and I had these ideas, and none of them on their own was enough to make a story for me. So I sat around and I tried to figure out how all the pieces interlocked, how they related to one another, how they resonated off one another. And I didn't know. I wandered around with the disparate parts of Witchmark in my head for probably about 6 months. And I was just kind of browsing the internet. That kind of that way where you're clicking through things and you're looking at pictures and you're kind of flitting from site to site. And you call it research so you don't feel guilty about not working.
I feel called out right now, CL. I'm just saying.
I'm calling myself out right now. And I was kind of wandering around because it was 2014, and there was a Twitter account that was recounting kind of a live tweet recap of the First World War. And I clicked the link, and it was a picture of a bunch of soldiers standing in a street, obviously on parade. And I looked at it and everything kind of clicked in that moment. I was like, these are alien soldiers. They have come home from the war. Miles sees them and he is horrified by what he sees. Why? And when I had the answer, I had the story.
It sounds fantastic. And especially since on the Skiffy and Fanti blog, Paul Weimer actually reviewed Witchmark and gave it a glowing review. So given that it seems much beloved, and I want to read it now for sure, when does book two come out?
Book two is coming out soon. I'm still writing book two.
It's a much more common answer than you might think.
Okay. I am still writing book two. Book two has been kind of a slippery beast because I have to take the huge implications of the ending of Witchmark, and I have to continue them so that people know what happened in the story. But at the same time, I've kind of set myself up with this, I'm going to call it like a story type, where I have a fantasy with a mystery and a romance all smushed together. And the story is going to continue basically where Witchmark left off. And it's going to deal with the consequences of the ending of Witchmark, which I will not share because spoilers.
Of course.
and that I'm passing the baton to a controversial character in Witchmark. I'm passing the narrative on to Miles' sister, Grace, who some people really love. Some people want to drown in a bucket.
That's the best kind of character. That sounds fun. So let us know where we can find you and Witchmark.
The best place to find me is actually on my Twitter, which is at CLPolk. I have a website, clpolk.com, that you can use for the contact me. That's how you find me. If you want to find my book, well, it's just about everywhere. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it at Barnes & Noble. You can buy it at Kobo and Book Depository and Powell's online. And because it made the Indie Next list in the summertime, you can actually find the print version of the book in various brick and mortar stores near you. So if you want to order it from a real store, you can do that.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, CL, for joining us today and telling us about Witchmark.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for hanging out with us. We appreciate it. Make sure that you go to your nearest book retailer online, brick and mortar, up to you, and buy a copy of Witchmark by C.L. Polk. And with that, awkward ending and scene. Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have the phenomenal Tanya Thompson, horror writer and creator and executive producer of Nightlight Podcast, the Black Speculative Fiction Podcast. Welcome to the show, Tanya.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
How could I not do this?
I mean, there are a lot of ways. I can think of a lot of ways. But...
Right, but you basically tortured me and made me do it, so,
yes,
you know.
Yes, there is that. There is that. I'm glad that you did it while you still have teeth in your mouth. I didn't want to have to take them all.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I do need a few for speaking. It's just a little bit handy. So, obviously, we're getting into the mood for Halloween, which is very appropriate for what you do, which is, as I said, horror. So, before we get into everything else, though, just tell us about yourself and your work in general.
All right. Well, I'm a horror writer. I've been writing horror for a long time, since like the second grade. Anything that I can do to scare people, I love scaring people. I run a podcast, and I enjoy hiking and sleeping and the rain and great salsa. I make great salsa.
Three out of those four things are my favorite things in the world.
Which one is not your favorite?
Anything involving movement.
Okay.
So before we get into the podcast, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about your multimedia Twitter horror stories.
Oh.
What made you start writing those and creating those? Because it's not just a writing process. They are multimedia.
Yeah. You know, honestly, like the first one that I wrote wasn't even like intentionally a story. It was just like something that I told people, and I can't even remember what it was at this point, but it was something that had actually happened and people were super interested in it. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, that was pretty cool. Like, you know, people were sharing that and, you know, tweeting it out or whatever. And I was like, I should do stories on Twitter because I'm partial to short stories and multimedia and things like that. So, you know, it was kind of, I'm not really a novel person. Like, I tried writing a novel and I cried the whole time. So, you know, I decided just to, you know, kind of take what I was good at and what I enjoyed and do that, even if it doesn't make me a lot of money. Any money, I should say. although I have made like $10. Somebody tipped me $10 for
Sweet.
A Twitter story, which was really great. That was like the best day of my life. But yeah, so like one day I woke up, I had taken a nap and I woke up with blood on my face, and it was just like a tiny bit of blood. Like I'd had like a zit or something that I'd scratched and, you know, made it bleed. And I was like, oh, that would make an amazing story. Like if, you know, you just woke up and there was blood all over your face and you had no recollection of what happened and, you know, what could you do with that? And so that was kind of where the first, you know, real story that I really started to bring, you know, like the pictures and editing and all kinds of stuff into the process. So I brought my kid into it because I'm an excellent mother. And
yes, the best, honestly.
And, you know, I'm like, well, let's make some blood. We do, you know, I had some ketchup, but I was like, I don't want to make blood out of ketchup. That's boring. I want it to taste good because, you know, it should taste good.
Corn syrup and red dye.
I used chocolate syrup.
Ooh, nice.
And red dye. Because I did want the blood to look a little bit dried. So yeah, made a big bowl of chocolate syrup blood and had my son smear it on me and take a bunch of pictures of me sleeping, quote unquote, for a nap. And, you know, he had a blast. He enjoyed it. He put blood all over his face. We took a few shots of him, like, you know, pretending he was dead, and he thought it was a blast and it was really cool. And, you know, I still have pictures of both of us eating the syrup, like, right out of the bowl.
Of course. I was going to say, that's the biggest perk of that job.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and he got an official credit for it. You know, I was like, I'll put you in the credits for it. You know, you're the photographer and, you know, all of that. So, you know, he's been really excited. He's actually helped me with quite a few stories at this point. He's 8 now. I think he was 7 when I first started doing the stories. But he's become a really great photographer for me. He does some videography as well. And we kind of collaborate on a lot of stories. He's like, oh, Mom, I have this great idea for a scary story for you to tell. You know, he provides a lot of inspiration for them. And it's a lot of fun. It's something that we love to do together. Although I haven't done a story in some time now. I'm hoping to get back into them sometime later this month.
What do you think is the main benefit of telling stories in that fashion?
Well, I think one thing is, you know, one, there's definitely pictures that you can add. You know, if you write just a short story and it's published, you know, in a magazine or whatever, you know, there's not an opportunity to add pictures, and you can't really Photoshop things. And, you know, in a way, Twitter lets you tell a story, but that's also a little bit like a movie to some degree, or a graphic novel. So you can include videos and you can include photos and, you know, all kinds of cool stuff. You can put funny GIFs in, which I think I can get into a whole conversation about how humor and horror kind of go together. And you can use humor to disarm your reader, listener, watcher, etc., and make them think nothing is going to happen, but then, you know, hit them with something really horrific right on the heels of something that they just laughed at, which I think heightens the horror aspect of it. But then also, like, you know, relieves some of that tension so that it becomes more than just like, this is a scary experience. It's, you know, a fun, scary experience. But, you know, for me, like, I've always enjoyed art, but the photography aspect allows me to kind of play in that world and, you know, set things up and really provide the visuals for what I'm saying. I think that also, you know, another one of the benefits is that it's a medium where, you know, if people are watching you live tweet it, then there's also this aspect of suspense that's kind of built in, which you don't have if you have a whole story there, you know, for someone to read or listen to. You know, there is some suspense there if you write it well, obviously. But there's added suspense when, you know, you start a sentence and you say, and then, you know, dot, dot, dot. And they're like, oh, my God. And, you know, and they're refreshing. Like, I get so many people saying, hurry up. We're waiting for the next one. Like, once I was telling a story and I don't know, something happened and I had to, like, step away for a second. My son needed something or my dog needed something. You know, something happened at home that I had to tend to. And so I was away for like 5 minutes in the middle of the story. And like, so many people were like, what's taking so long? Are you dead?
I remember, cause there was that one that just took off, that the guy wrote about how he had a doppelganger that was taking over his life.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Where
yeah.
He was like at a hotel in Mexico and, you know, the same room and all of that stuff. And people were hooked on that story, but it didn't actually resolve for months. Talk about building tension.
Yeah. And, you know, I've found that the stories that I tell as, you know, from first person, first of all, and then also stories that could be happening, you know, like it's not something so outrageous. Like I told this story about a lake monster And, you know, people liked it, but it wasn't as popular as the other stories where, you know, like I've literally had people telling me, like, do you have an alarm system? You should get an alarm system. Like, that's weird. Like, you know, they're legitimately scared for me, even though, like, I start at the very beginning of the story and say, you know, it's story time, you know. Because the first time I did it, I didn't tell people it was story time. And I had people, like, seriously worried about my safety and, you know, until I got to the end and they were like, oh, wait a minute, that wasn't real. And I don't want to give away the ending for, you know, anyone who hasn't read it, but it was the nap story. And then, you know, people read it and they were like, I don't know if I hate you or I love you right now. Because, you know, they were believing it the whole time. And then, you know, at the end, like the ending makes it obvious that this is, you know, not something that actually happened. And, you know, people were just blown away. And I think, you know, one, a lot of people really like the stories that are somewhat believable and told in the first person, even if they know that it's not real. You know, a lot of my regular followers know, but they still get more involved in the ones that could plausibly be real, you know, even to the point where they know that it's not real, but they'll say, hey, sis, I'm worried about you. Like, do you need me to come check on you? Kind of thing. And, you know, they're participating in the story, which is really, really cool. Like, I love it that it's kind of like they're playing along with it as though it were a real story. And, you know, it's like, it also becomes an experience for me, which is amazing.
And then people who are coming in from outside are seeing that interaction and seeing how that builds into the story. And even if it's not something that you necessarily planned, it still makes it an immersive experience, which I think is really kind of cool. So what would you say were your main influences for kind of the direction that your work has taken? Because obviously you've written traditional horror stories, but it seems to me, especially with the podcast, that your work is kind of taking this direction towards a cross-media template of storytelling. So what do you think influenced that path?
I think it was a number of things, actually. You know, one, I tend to write better stories when I have some sort of box that I have to fit in. So, you know, with audio, I have to make this story work for just, you know, things that you listen to. It can't be pictures. It can't be, you know, anything that someone has to see or feel. It has to be something that will come through with audio and, you know, make them feel it, but not feel like I'm saying, okay, and now the bad guy points a gun at someone, you know, and that takes all the suspense out of it. Right. So there's that. I think I work best in places where I have to try to make things work with limitations. I don't work as well when there are no limitations, which is kind of what happens on the page. You know, you can tell anybody what you want to say. You can write it all out. There's no budget. There's no anything. You just write it down and it's in the reader's mind. And I think I get kind of overwhelmed with choices in those, but when there are limitations, I'm limited by what I can do. And there aren't quite so many choices as to what I can do. So I feel more confident, I think, in moving forward with what I decide. But then also, I think, you know, there's this aspect of necessity. It's, you know, it's hard to break in anywhere, really, you know, whether you're just, you know, writing like traditional novels or if you're writing screenplays or podcasts. And I think podcasts in particular are the type of media with the fewest gatekeepers at this point. You know, you can go out and you can buy a microphone and you can get started for, you know, $100. I mean, you can get started for free if you really wanted to. It wouldn't be great quality, but you could get started for free. And, you know, I've always been the type of person that I've often wanted to take the beaten path to get somewhere, but it doesn't always work for me, either because I'm weird or because I just, you know, want to do things that are different. You know, I don't know what it is, but the beaten path doesn't always work well for me. And so, you know, kind of finding the back door into being able to do things that I want to do is my forte. And so, you know, when it came down to audio fiction, for one, like I was a big listener of old time radio before podcasts were even a thing. You know, there were just radio stations on iTunes and I was listening to old time radio shows and I was like, oh my God, I want to do this one day. And when Twitter came along, you know, I kind of fell into it just because I was just sharing an experience and people seemed to like it. And then I thought, well, you know, I could do some cool stuff with this. I could, you know, share some stories with people and that might be kind of cool. And it might be a good way for me to kind of build a platform and get some recognition and, you know, also get my work out there and not have to be, you know, submitting it to all these places because I am not cut out for that world of, you know, submit your stories to 17 different places and all of them say no. And then the 18th one is like, okay, yeah, we'll publish it. And here's $30, you know, kind of thing.
So I guess that brings us to Nightlight. You've talked about it a little bit, but tell our listeners everything. Why did you start it? And where do you see it going from where it is right now?
Oh, like I said, I've been wanting to start a podcast for a really long time. Since before podcasts were called podcasts, since before the iPod existed. So it's kind of weird in that respect. But, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to start. I knew I wanted to start something that was related to horror because that's kind of always been my thing and, you know, something that I've enjoyed. And I thought that audio was a great medium for. And I've always put it off. You know, it's been like, I don't have enough time. You know, it's not the right time. I don't have enough money. I don't have this, that. And, you know, finally one day I was just like, I'm never going to do this. Like, this is something that I want to do and I'm never going to do it if I wait for the right time. And so, I tweeted about it because I was like, if I tweet about it, then people are going to ask about it and I can't back out of this. So, which is kind of like my method for a lot of things is like when I need to get something done, I'll tweet about it and then people are counting on it. And I'm like, crap, I have to do this now.
Peer pressure. It's an amazing thing.
Yes. Yes. So I try to use it to my advantage. But yeah, so it's, you know, I put it out there and I created an Indiegogo campaign because I want to pay writers. I don't want to be one of those places that's like, hey, we'll give you some exposure and you should be happy for that. And I wasn't going to have enough money to just pay people. I was like, this is going to cost us a lot of money. So put up the Indiegogo campaign, raised some money. People were super excited about it. And it's been going ever since June 26th. Was our launch date. So I'm pretty excited about it. It's pretty awesome. And I've got some amazing volunteers like yourself.
Yay!
that are keeping this thing running. I mean, honestly, like, you know, it's funny. I look back on it and I'm like, you know, I did this because I knew I was never going to do it if I didn't just do it. But also like, this is the absolute worst time in my life to have started a podcast. Like, so I've been able to hold on to my sanity and my health. Because of the volunteers, which is fabulous. So thank you.
You're very welcome. I have way too much fun with it. Obviously, October is a big month for horror fans, clearly.
Yes.
As evidenced by your amazing pants and my amazing new hairdo.
Yes. Spiderweb team.
Exactly. So what are you doing on Nightlight Podcast to celebrate the month of October?
Yeah, so we're doing a number of things. We're kind of giving a preview of our bonus content, one of which is True Frights, where we tell true paranormal or scary experiences that people submit to us. So if you have a story that you want to submit it, and, you know, we'll work our magic and write it and make it cool and put the audio production behind it and make your real life experience come to life for everyone else. We're also doing a preview of some interviews that we have with various folks in Black horror, where we talk about Black horror movies or books. We have episode coming up about the Blaxploitation movie Abby. And we're also going to kind of bring Blaxploitation back, but bring it to the podcast world. And we're going to take creepypasta stories and kind of reimagine them from a Black perspective and, you know, kind of rewrite a lot of these stories, although they'll be significantly different in some ways. The first one is going to be about Slender Man.
Ooh.
Yes, I'm super excited about that. And then we have a big surprise for our Halloween special. It's going to be an audio drama, so, you know, more like live action sort of stuff. But that's all the details that I'm going to give for now.
Yes.
Yes.
It's going to be glorious.
It really is. I'm super excited about it. Like, I'm terrified, but I'm also really excited.
It's going to be amazing. Like, super duper extra amazing.
I hope so. I'm terrified it's not going to be, like, intellectually, like, I know that it's going to be fine. and it's probably going to be really awesome. You know, I've got some amazing voice actors lined up, and you know, you and I work in the audio stuff. Like, it's going to be great. But then also I'm like kind of terrified because it's like, what if people don't like this? What if it's not good? Like, what am I doing with my life?
It's your baby going out into the world. It's okay to be a little bit freaked out by that. That's the real horror in life.
Yes. Oh, there's another story idea.
All right, so why don't you tell everybody where they can find you and Nightlight Podcast and your work?
All right, so I am pretty much everywhere on social media as Miss Defying, MissDefying, on Twitter and on Instagram. Nightlight is on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter as Nightlight Pod. We're also on Patreon at patreon.com/nightlightpod. And you can visit my actual website, which I never update, at TonyaThompson.com, TonyaThompson.com.
Fantastic. So thank you so much for coming on the show today, Tanya.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on Signal Boost. Make sure you go check out Nightlight Podcast and everything that Tanya has ever done.
Good night. Happy Halloween.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.